Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
This episode of EU Startups Podcast is brought to you by Vonta. Whether you're starting or scaling your company's security program, demonstrating top-notch security practices and establishing trust is more important than ever. Vonta automates compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more, saving you time and money while helping you build customer trust. Plus, you can streamline security reviews by automating questionnaires and demonstrating your security posture with a customer-facing trust center, all powered by Vonta AI. Over 7,000 global companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vonta to manage risk and prove security in real time. Get a special offer of $1,000 off at vonta.com/EU Startups. That's vanta.com/EU Startups.
Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups podcast. My guest today is Jan Reichelt, awarded European Founder of the Year 2013 by TechCrunch, now turned a founding partner of 10x Founders, a network-driven investor backed by over 200 entrepreneurs and angels. 10x founding partners have been the first backers of unicorns such as Adyen, Luminar, Palantir, and the list goes on. Their investments over the last 16 years include 16 unicorns, and they've had more than 40 notable exits and 8 IPOs. This super angel expertise is implemented in the 10x founders strategy. Jan, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Hi, Marcin. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Amazing. So let's dive right into it, Jan. How do you actually, so I know a bit about you already where we spoke before the podcast, but I also did a pretty extensive research on you. How do you view entrepreneurship as a lifestyle rather than just a career?
Yeah, I think this slogan, see entrepreneurship as a lifestyle, emerged when I first started to discover how intense being a startup founder actually is and how much it drives your thinking throughout the whole day. So it's so hard to differentiate between when are you working and when are you not working, or when are you working on your startup and when are you supposed to relax or do something different. So The differentiation between work and non-work as a founder is, in my experience, not really existent. So because you constantly think about the problems, your vision, how you can push forward. And because you constantly think about that, you can't switch it off. So it happens to you all the time. And if it happens to you all the time, then you need to find a way how you deal with that and how you manage, so to say, your time, how you manage that relationship between work and free time or non-work time. And I think as a founder, if you take it as a lifestyle decision and not as a career decision, then I think it's a much easier sell to yourself because you say, hey, I have chosen that path as my lifestyle. Rather, this is going to be my career and I need to switch career or something like this. Because you say, hey, you know, if things start to bother me at 8 o'clock in the evening, then you know you have a way out to say to yourself, well, that's normal because that's what you've signed up for.
So much easier to accept, exactly. And got you. So I already know that you've been an entrepreneur before you turned investor. What was the hardest part? And you sold your some of your businesses to other businesses. So I wanted to ask you, what was the hardest part of selling, let's say, Mendeley to Reed Elsevier? And did you have any second, or do you still have any second thoughts after selling your companies? Something you wish you'd have done differently?
Yeah. So in this case, in both cases, actually, I don't have any regrets or any second thoughts. I think both acquisitions were great acquisitions for all parties. I mean, I feel like to some extent, as a founder, you don't want to get acquired in a murky deal also, because usually that then is also nothing that has a long-term view. And up to this day, people talk to me about Mendeley and how great Mendeley is and how much it helped them. And then also Copernio, which is now rebranded as EndNote Click, accessing research papers. I also get feedback. I mean, it wasn't as well known as Mendeley, but still, to this day, and that's now 10 years on, obviously, It's great to hear from a founder's perspective that there are still people using your product and it survives within the big organization. So that's great. And that's why I do not have any regrets. You know, the second thoughts are obviously like, wow, I, you know, there are like two or three other ideas that I would have liked to try instead of maybe Mendeley or Copernio. But at some point, you just have to choose and pick and move on. And it was Mendeley and then Copernio. So the regret is more like, you know, what would have happened had I picked the other opportunity or the other project or the other idea? So that is more the thought.
And then so in terms of like curiosity rather than regret.
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's more like I wanted to try that as well. And actually, Copernio was a sequel to Mendeley because Mendeley was about research collaboration, so people organizing their research papers. But one of the problems in that industry was still how do you actually get access to research papers in the first place? And so Copernio was one of those ideas that we didn't really get to implement through Mendeley because you have these path dependencies where eventually also your option room is somewhat restricted in terms of what additional ideas you can do. Mm-hmm. But once Mendeley was integrated into Elsevier, we had scaled it to the institutions and so on, you know, there was a great opportunity to then try this other idea, which was always bumbling around in our minds. And that's what we did. But obviously, it's not just one idea. I mean, if you're a founder, entrepreneur, you have like whatever, 10 ideas in parallel going on what you could do. And so, you know, there's no regrets other than, this question around what would have happened if this curiosity, as you said. Yeah,
there's always this question. So, Jan, you've been on both sides of the table. Like, you've been founder, now you're investor. As a founder, how do you manage your emotions during the highs and lows?
I think that is, in fact, one of the biggest challenges for every founder. Because in theory, for every factual problem, there will likely be a factual solution, right? But the challenge is how you manage your emotions indeed throughout that process. Because you come into the office in the morning and something has fucked up and you say, oh, damn. And then the next day you feel like, wow, amazing, you signed a contract. And as I said, I think one of the base assumptions that I always took is, well, this is the lifestyle that I've chosen. Mm-hmm. So if I have these emotional ups and downs, well, you know, that's kind of, again, what I've chosen, so I need to get on and deal with it. But I think there are actually also very practical ways of how you can deal with it. And two or three of those are exercise. Physical exercise is as simple as that, because I think it does relax your mind. There are hormones in play that make you feel more relaxed and so on. And then
for your mind, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can feel this. I was running this morning, so I can just feel that I'm a lot more relaxed. Yeah. Now than I would have been had I not been running. 100%. And then the other things are social relationships. You know, don't forget your friends and family over your startup. Again, it comes back to if it's your lifestyle, then anyway, you have to integrate this into your lifestyle. And then lastly, what I always also did is I continue to travel and see other things. So I took the weekends. I mean, you still answer emails, but you know, I was sitting then in Lisbon answering emails whilst visiting a friend. So there are some things that you can actually do to deal with this emotional roller coaster, I think. Also, by the way, another thing is just talk to really good other entrepreneurs and be honest with each other. And that's, I think, what we're trying to do at 10x Founders, right? The network of entrepreneurs that we're creating.
The community that was
exactly. Put them together and, hey, you know, fine, you all want to be proud of what you're doing, but let's also be honest that most of the time, many things don't go according to plan. So share your experience.
Most of the time. 100%. Jan, are former entrepreneurs better investors? What's your take on this?
Well, so I don't know, quite frankly. It was indeed one of the questions that I did ask myself when I embarked on the investor journey, which was kind of partially inspired by my curiosity of things that I still wanted to do. I've looked into some of the research, you know, coming from this academic research background that I had. I've tried to find like some papers, and there are some indicators that, you know, what these papers say, successfully exited entrepreneurs, that they have potentially the likelihood of creating better outcomes for the portfolio companies or the companies that they invest in. Mm-hmm. But mostly the reason is likely that they can connect better to the founders and help the founders after the investment with scaling. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you've been there, you've done that, you might be a good conversation partner. And there wasn't any indication that it's due to better picking abilities or something like that. So again, it's inconclusive data. Some data points point in one direction, some others into another. I've written a blog post about that, by the way. You can check it out on my LinkedIn.
Nice.
Yeah.
Jan, so since we were here already, we were talking about founders turned VCs. What's 10x founders' edge? I know you have a network of unicorn backers, or bakers, let's call it. What's the no bullshit advantage that gives you this gives you over other VCs?
Yeah. Well, I think so. There are a few. One is most of the people in the team have been entrepreneurs themselves. When I was an entrepreneur myself, I felt there was still too few VCs investors who went through the entrepreneur journey. And if you look at the data, I think in Europe, there's 20% of VCs had been former entrepreneurs or operators or something like that. But I don't know the exact number, but it's certainly the minority. And it's just a different conversation that you can have when you've been in that shoes beforehand. And I think that is one of the elements that we have, in addition to what you just mentioned, the network. So we've invested and or built companies for many, many years before we did 10x Founders. So we have lots of experience. We have quite a big network, can put you in touch either with someone directly or probably just one call away. And that is the other thing. And then generally, maybe as a third point, as entrepreneurs, we invest like entrepreneurs, meaning we don't have super mathematical guidelines. We are quite flexible when we invest. We look at each startup and look at it, evaluate it based on its own merits, rather than having a standardized approach to things, because entrepreneurs are always flexible. So that's, I think, in a nutshell, how we are different.
Nicely. And this is actually what you're talking about now is actually the approach to investing with an entrepreneurial mindset, right? I also wanted to talk about it a bit, but you already answered that. So maybe let's move to what's a startup's red flag that instantly makes you think, nope, not for me? And what's a common mistake founders make that really drives you crazy?
Okay, well, first question, red flags. I don't really think, actually, funny enough, we have any real red flags, because again, if we say, and we're honest, we want to be honest with ourselves, we look at each startup based on its own merits, well, there might always be good reasons to invest and always be reasons why maybe we don't want to invest. But to define beforehand what would be a red flag, is difficult to define. I mean, they're the obvious things, right? We wouldn't invest in drugs and, we wouldn't invest in illegal stuff and these types of things. Yeah, fine. Yeah. But apart from that, if we feel the founder is a great founder, great founding team, they show integrity, the product is maybe something unusual. Actually, that's what we're actually looking for, more of the unusual stuff. So we don't really have red flags. It's always a balance between what are strong signals that would argue for an investment here. And again, I think that's a quite entrepreneurial style of investing rather than approaching this with a checklist.
That sounds amazing. I love it. More green lights than the red lights.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and then I was just trying to remember your second question.
It was about what's the, common mistake founders make that drives you crazy.
Ah, that's a good one also. Yes. Again, everybody might have their own view, but my contribution to that question would be, I personally think founders should not listen too much to investors or outside, quote unquote, experts more generally. My experience has been, sometimes I think I made the mistake, or we even as a founder team made the mistake, that we thought, oh, these investors, they're also experienced, or all these business angels that we had, they must know better. And we've sometimes listened a bit too much, I feel, to some of this external advice. But what actually is the situation is, you as the founder, you're the only one that really has the complete picture, which still is a totally gray cloud. But nevertheless, it's only you who can really put all the dots together, pieces of the puzzle, and eventually make the decision. So that's why we always say and expect to our founders, you run the business, you're the CEO, you're the founding team, you decide. We might have an opinion, but don't expect us to take your decision, to expect us to take the decision for you. And we really look for strong founders who get that, right? Who we believe will be able to figure it out by themselves.
I love it, Jan. You're just building another fan of 10X here while having this conversation. Tell me why is being intrigued by, you know, unconventional ideas a positive sign?
So maybe, again, it's tainted by my own experience that I was quite successful with ideas which I would call non-obvious problems. You know, problems that you only discover once you actually dig a little bit deeper. And that might be special industries, niche industries. It might be complex problems, complex products. So we've invested a lot, obviously, in AI stuff, deep tech most recently. Historically, we've done a lot of B2B SaaS, and we still invest in that, and they're still fantastic companies. But, you know, we, and I personally, and we as a team, we also have been quite intrigued by these, what we would just call, well, either non-obvious problems or complex complex solutions, right? So that is a mix of hardware and software, or you know, deep tech stuff, where, you know, I'll give you an example, Ixana. And they basically build a next generation Bluetooth chip where you can transfer data by shaking hands, which is just like from a sci-fi movie. And you wouldn't believe it if you weren't able to see it. And so these types of things and these non-obvious things, whenever we see an idea that makes it, that sounds strange and that sounds odd, our first reaction is, okay, let's have a look.
Let's dig into it. Yeah, 100%. Like, so, you know, the ideas that are a bit uncomfortable or like scary for people to think about or talk about. This is it. These are maybe not often, but sometimes turn out the ideas that will change the whole or create a whole new industry and change the world.
Yeah.
100%. Jan, how important is storytelling for founders? And what is, and why is it actually, you know, often underestimated?
Yeah, I think storytelling is super important for fundraising on the one hand, right? And as a founder, the thing that you're always concerned about is kind of, you know, how's my next round going to look like? So you always need to be able to tell your story to investors. But it's the same if you look at it internally into the company. If you're able to motivate people by, you know, telling them, you know, what are you trying to do? What is the path that you're choosing? How do you get there? So you really need to communicate and ideally over-communicate. And sometimes I've detected like, I'm saying this again. And then, yes, I'm saying this again. And I'm repeating myself. I'm telling the strategy again. I'm telling the vision again. Because this is what brings people along when you are in uncharted territory. What you're doing when you're a startup. Because you need to tell people what is the way ahead, because otherwise no one else will. So that's why I think storytelling is so super important, both for external reasons as well as internal reasons.
Exactly. So there has to be this balance, you know, because so we have to develop the products and ideas together with people and together with the users. But sometimes as a founder, you just gotta like tell people what's next, right? Because like you can't only depend on people to kind of co-develop it to check whether this is a good idea or not, right?
Yes, I completely agree. Yeah, you have to, and you have to throw some pieces of the communication just into the group. And quite frankly, I do think it makes you better as well, because if you have a good team, you will get feedback. You will see whether what you're saying resonates. And then you can also, as the founder, improve on your storytelling, right? So it's the same as when you do iterative product development. You could basically say you do iterative improvements on storytelling. And I think that makes you a lot stronger if you're starting with this right at the beginning.
Yeah. Jan, what's the piece of advice you've got for founders that most people are scared to say?
I think it does come back to this point which we had earlier, is don't listen too much to other people. Don't listen too much to your investors. You know, I mean, in the sense of take that feedback, but don't think that this is the right thing. And you will have people, and it could be an institutional investor, could also be an angel investor, They are all usually very strongly opinionated. I mean, on the one hand, if you have angel investors, they are usually founders themselves. So by definition, they will always have a very strong opinion on what you should be doing and should not be doing.
Yeah.
And if you look at the investor side, you know, they put a lot of money on the table to enable you. And so they have lots of money at stake. So they also want to be heard and want to share their opinion. But in the end, I think you really need to trust your gut. And I would encourage everybody to really trust, as a founder, trust your gut more than you think, and then keep moving and then keep iterating.
Nice. So it's like, it's generally like in life, like you should be open for, you know, other people's ideas and gather as much of them as and perspectives and gather as much of them as you can. But at the end, you know, you don't have to do what other people tell you to do or listen to those ideas directly or blindly. You gotta, you know, gather those old opinions and then like still come up with something that is your own and like then follow it.
Absolutely right. So. And that brings, in my view, brings us full circle to this notion of take entrepreneurship as a lifestyle, because it's not just a question that you need to ask yourself about a career or profession. No, it impacts your whole life. And so if you take that approach, I think it will be much easier to follow your gut and that principle.
Totally agree. Jan, you already mentioned that you like recently invested in a lot of AI stuff and deep tech. Why are startups back to doing hard things? And do you have, you already mentioned one, do you have any other cool examples from your portfolio?
So why are people back to doing this? Well, a couple of reasons. I do think we now have more technologies available that enable startup founders to tackle bigger problems, just generally speaking. That's one of the things. I think there's also more, let's say, supply and understanding on the investor side for more difficult problems. I mean, if you look at, you know, how many investors are going for AI startups, deep tech startups, wasn't such a thing before, right? I mean, I think investors today are potentially more interested also in hardware than maybe, you know, 10 years ago, where it was more of a niche and so on. So I think this is you know, a reason why people are doing more in these sectors. And when I think about the companies that we have invested in, so one other great example is Magic.dev. It's a European team, but they are developing basically a next generation co-pilot. They have amazing co-investors with Capital G by now and Matt Friedman and the like. So, you know, they are on the way to becoming a unicorn, I think. And if they solve that problem, then basically code generation is being solved. I know there are quite a few other startups on that topic as well, but Magic is doing extremely well. And then there's another startup we've recently invested in, which is called Thaleron. And what they do basically is they develop a technology to store energy below sea level at a fraction of the original cost. So it's an amazing idea. They do this by building actually mechanical flywheels that have, you know, this storage capacity, but that only works below the sea level because you need some external pressure. Otherwise, like some of the forces that work on the structures are so strong. And so all these crazy ideas, like where you think like, wow, that's amazing. You know, we are able to invest in, which is great to see. And we really, I mean, I personally enjoy these, what I call complex.
It's the best job ever. Like, come on, it's the best job in the world. Like you're exposed to the most talented people in the world, solving some of the hardest problems and working with them, having this position to support them. Like, this is amazing.
I must say, there is one caveat with that. The thrill of you building that thing, that startup yourself, is quite significantly higher than as an investor, where you're quite frankly just the bystander. You're trying to help, you're applauding when it works well, you're trying to help when it doesn't work well, but you're always a step removed from where the stuff is really happening, both the good stuff and the shitty stuff. And from an emotional perspective, that's a completely different thing. And when I think back, you know, that is probably the biggest difference from my life now versus my life as an entrepreneur.
Yeah. I mean, the high that you get building something that's gonna, you know, impact lives of so many people is just the high you want to, you know, keep on having, like get back to having. Like it's a different kind of high than...
It's almost like a drug, right? You're always working to solve this next problem, build your next piece of the company and just feel accomplished. And that gives you a lot of energy as a founder.
100%. Jan, we already talked about AI, deep tech. What's a tech trend everyone is hyped about that you think is totally overblown?
Well, the interesting thing is we don't really look so much at trends. We're not trend investors, you know, like we're not looking for trends and then try to follow that trend. We invest in great founders doing great stuff, you know, and as a result, it happened that we have invested in more AI than before. And as a result, it has happened that we've invested in more deep tech than before. But it's not because, oh, we now need to invest in deep tech. Because, again, like when we invest like pre-seed and seed, you invest in basically the people rather than the trend. And what if AI is not a trend anymore in 5 years, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't want to be trend investors. We want to be entrepreneurs investing in entrepreneurs. And so that's why I don't really have a strong opinion on what is a trend that is totally overhyped. I think, you know, I would say maybe some valuations in certain areas, you know, seem to have been exaggerated. Those have come down, you know, which is a good thing for everyone, I think. But in terms of trends, I wouldn't be really able to say what is an overhyped trend.
Yeah, all right. So we don't care about the trends. We care about investing in the most brightest and talented people in the world.
That's at least what we're trying to do, yeah.
Amazing. Jan, what's your most expensive fuck-up and how did you bounce back from it?
The most expensive fuck-up probably was... I can't tell you a number how expensive it was, but I think it was quite expensive because I guess it costs us probably like 6 months of time. And if you then multiply that by burn, you know, it probably gives you some number. So what happened is it was when I did Mendeley. When people introduced their research papers into Mendeley as a document and collaboration system, what the Mendeley would do, it would create a public page for that document under Mendeley.com. So Mendeley.com/catalog/ and then, you know, some details about that paper. And if I introduced the document into Mendeley, it would create a page. And if you went ahead and had the same paper, it would create another page. So basically a duplicate of that page. So the result was, and we didn't deduplicate, and the result was we had a huge catalog of, non-deduplicated papers. So you know, lots of duplicate pages. And eventually, Google penalized us for that and de-indexed our whole web page. And then obviously, that led to a huge drop in traffic. And we needed to kind of basically reset the whole search engine optimization type of project. And anybody who knows search engine optimization, and especially back in the day, is like a black box, takes ages. You don't really know exactly what you need to do. So we really needed to start from scratch. And I think that was one of the biggest fuck-ups that we had back in the day. And it led to a huge loss in traffic and sign-ups and a headache. Don't even want to remember, to be honest.
And how did you bounce back from it? Like, what did it...
Well, keep moving. What are you supposed to do? Give up? Huh? You know? There's no way of giving up. So, yeah, back to zero. Start again. You know, pick yourselves up. In this case, reprioritize, put together task force, and just do it. I mean, there's no other way. Keep moving. And funnily enough, is also an advice to founders, I would say, you know, just keep moving. Because if you manage to keep moving, you will not die. And if you are not dying as a startup, you retain your chance of making it big.
I love it. Jan, we're getting slowly to the end of this podcast, so let's chill out a bit. How do you keep... You already, you know, I asked you this question about like how do you manage as a founder your highs and lows, but maybe you can now answer this question yourself a bit more. How do you keep the balance between hustle and chill?
Yeah, it comes back to this question of taking entrepreneurship as a lifestyle is one thing. not being too strict with yourself about, you know, what you're doing. Are you productive? Are you not productive? I think if you're a founder and you're passionate about something, then you will be working on this thing anyway all the time. And so I think you will discover that eventually you feel like, wow, maybe it's now time to pull back a bit. And then you need to look for these other alternatives. And, you know, we discussed this, you know, beforehand, you have a little daughter, I have a little daughter. You know, this is then the moment where you then think, well, you know, your daughter doesn't really care so much whether your catalog got de-indexed, right? And all this kind of stuff. They want to have a great family. They want, in our case, they want to have great dads. And and keeping that balance and that mindset, I think, is quite important. And that will help you to keep that balance between hustle and chill.
I love it. I love the answer. Let's have some fun towards the end, Jan. If you could invite anyone to a dinner party for top entrepreneurs and investors, I don't know, dead or alive, who would be your top picks, and what kind of food would you choose? And what would your party playlist as well?
That's an interesting mix. I think if I had to put these three, like the people, the food and the music together, I don't think it would be an automatic match, because I think I have quite different preferences for each. But starting with the interesting people, I think I wouldn't be able to name one particular person right now, or wouldn't be willing to. What I would try to look for is, you know, someone basically who really fell down, went through the shit process and then got up again, right? So that could be a sports person. And maybe some of you have seen the speech of Roger Federer recently, which was great. You know, it could be someone running an NGO, like a big global NGO. You know, it could be someone who is trying to muddle through the diplomacy process, you know, at the United Nations, where you get slapped, where you get kind of slapped in your face left and right, and you need to somehow find a solution. Like someone, people who really face problems but are not from the startup world. Because I think the startup world, like you can, you know, call a founder, you can listen to podcasts, but I would find it very interesting to get some comparisons and see, well, those guys who are trying to save the Amazon rainforest, they really have problems. And to compare yourself, let's say, and that puts your problems back into a different perspective. So this is the type of people I would be looking for. In terms of food, I think I would be very uncontroversial. I would go with Italian. I love Italian food. I think people do, you know. So I think that's a pretty straightforward thing. And then in terms of music, I guess I would put, easy house, vocal house, electronic type of music. Though, again, that is not my personal preference. My personal preference are some obscure Latin type music styles. So again, I would have to choose. Is it my personal preference, or is it something that's more compatible with other people?
Okay, got it. Do you also dance some Latin music? Yes. I know your wife is Brazilian.
Yes, I do. In fact, in my former life, I was a professional salsa instructor.
What? Nice.
Yes,
and we got that at the end of the show. That's amazing.
Yes.
It would have changed the whole order of questions had I known before.
Yeah, at some point I got distracted from dancing and ended up being a VC.
Oh man, it's like a professional salsa dancer turned VC. This is amazing.
Well, there were a few startups in between, but yeah.
Okay, got it. Jan, it's a wrap. Everyone, clap for Jan. Thank you for being on the show. It was so awesome to have you, and it's been such a great conversation. I hope to meet you in person soon and continue the conversation. And I wish you all the best, Jan. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the nice questions. It was a great conversation.
Glad you liked it. Ciao.